So the period that we're going to talk about now is called the Zugot, period of the Zugot pairs. In each generation, between Shimon and Tzadik and Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, you had a pair of sages. Recognize him from this side?
He already made him.
Sorry. Okay.
Similar Fisher-esque.
Fine.
Comment.
So the clearest source on this is the Mishnah in Chagiga. It's the third source in front of you. Yosef ben Yoezer Omer Shalo Lismoch. Right? There was this dispute about smicha, whether or not you do smicha, which is whether you lean on a carbon that you bring on Shabbat. Yosef ben Yoezer says no. Yosef ben Yochanan says yes. Yeshua ben Parachia says no. Nitai Ha'arbeli says yes. Yudah ben Tabai says no. Shimon ben Shetach says yes. Shmaya says yes. Avtalion says no.
Hillel debates also this Mishnah?
So it's in Chagiga. Hillel and Menachem didn't disagree. Menachem was deposed. Shammai took his place. Shammai said not to do smicha, and Hillel said to do smicha. Harishonim hayu nesiim, ushniim lahem av beit din. That in each of these pairs, the first one was the nasi, the president of the Sanhedrin, and the second one was the av beit din, the head of the beit din of the Sanhedrin in Yerushalayim. We're spanning here close to 300 years, from about the year, right, if Antigonos is after Shimon HaTzadik. Shimon HaTzadik, we said, was around the time of Alexander. So that means Antigonos is at the beginning of the Greek era, which is about 300 BC, and this process ends around before a few generations before the Churban. Right? Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai were already established as independent schools by the time of the Churban. So we're talking around the year 1, right? So we're talking about 300 years. Maybe a little bit less. These years...
Year 1?
Yeah, there's no year 0.
What are we saying? What was the year 1?
Jeez. Meaning from around the year 300 before the Common Era until around the year 1 of the Common Era, until like the turn of the eras,
what
is the period of the Zugot. And it's pretty clear that there wasn't necessarily.
Number 1. What's that? Where are you? Jesus.
No, I'm saying.
It's not the calendar. It has to do with the calendar. It happens to be that that was the date.
I'm saying
the
that Hillel.
Right.
Correct.
Hillel, around the time that the common era started.
Around that time, correct. Maybe a little bit later, maybe like a generation later. So. This period is one of the most creative periods in all of Jewish history. There's almost nothing like it. If you think about what was produced by the Jewish people during these few hundred years, and include the first century of the Common Era as well, it's phenomenal. You have, all right, I'm going to throw it out. What do you have that's produced in that era?
The Mishnah.
The Mishnah is produced around the year 200.
It's finalized, but this was all the Mishnahs that were learned. These guys were in the Mishnah.
These guys are in maybe a dozen or two Mishnayos.
Well, what's the logic of that will be going to be used for the next 400 or 500 years?
Okay.
But Hillel,
but that's the tail end of this. That's Hillel and Shammai. I'm talking
before.
Before. This is the period.
The whole, I don't know if this is the right word, dialectical, not combative nature of the Torah Academy. If we're talking before this was Antigonus and Nevi'im, those are usually not guys who argue with each other. The whole idea of learning Torah through taking sides in an argument, which seems to be, I don't know if that was the problem with Apelion, that he didn't disagree, so he's useless. We got to move to a pair that disagrees.
Well, Shmaya and Apelion did disagree. It's Menachem.
Menachem
didn't disagree. So yeah, there's dispute, but in those few hundred years, you only have one dispute, the dispute about Smicha. What you do have, though...
All these things are just houses of dispute and a system of disputation.
What you do have produced in this time, in this era, and we didn't know about it at the time. The Torah is translated into Greek in this era. We mentioned that. You have the works of what's called the Apocrypha, the Svarim Chitzoniim, are produced in this era. In this era, the Book of the Jubilees and Sefer HaChashonim, the Book of the Maccabees, Ben Sira, all these books that didn't make it into our Tanakh, but that were produced by Jews, written for Jews, usually produced in Hebrew, even though in most cases the Hebrew is no longer extant. You have a lot of the material that was produced in the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in the 1940s, and all of a sudden you have this trove of Jewish documents which are non-rabbinic.
Those were not from the Churban era?
Some of them were from the era, meaning it's pre-Churban. The material was mostly written down in the first century, but some of it, or a lot of it, was material that goes back much earlier, like to the first, the second even, centuries before the Common Era. You have, in the first century, you have Josephus, who, in addition to writing his histories, also writes a chronicle of basically what Judaism is. And he writes about, this is what Jews do. And it's one of the first accounts that we have of what Jewish practice is, what is halacha. And Philo, a Greek-speaking Jew in Alexandria, also in the first century, writes about what Jews do. And a lot of it is similar to what we do. A lot of it is similar to what we're familiar with. And a lot of it is out of left field. A lot of it is stuff that we don't have any... There's no analog with it. There's no analog to it in our halacha.
For instance?
For instance, I'll have to get back to you next week. We can pull up... Any page of Josephus in his book called The Special Laws and start reading. Let's do that. A little experiment. Philo. Special Laws.
Philo's book, not Josephus.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I meant Philo. Okay, now you have the entire text on a website called Early Christian Writings, which tells you all you need to know. Okay, this is talking about Brit Milah. Maybe we shouldn't use that one. So why do they do it? Talk about it being preventative of painful disease, an affliction difficult to be cured, which they call carbuncle. It secures the cleanliness of the whole body. Okay, this is time of the crow. This is explains. Yeah.
It doesn't bring down bagels or anything.
No. Okay, I think we're going to have to move on to find some examples. Okay.
So in the early days, there was no the Mishnah Chagiga means. That's all they argued about, was the issue with leaning.
Yeah.
Smicha.
Yeah. That's what it means. If you take a look at the next... If you take a look at the next source, the Tosefta in Sanhedrin, Rabbi Yossi gives a little history. Amar Rabbi Yossi. Barishona lo ya machloket b'Yisrael. There was no dispute at all. Beitin shel shivim ve'echad, shehayu b'lishkat ha-gazit. There was a bezdin in lishkat ha-gazit on Har HaBayit. Shar batei dinim shel esrim v'shlosh shehayu b'ayarot shel Yisrael. And you had batei din in every town. Shnei batei dinin shel gimel hayu b'Yerushalayim. That should be chav gimel. Echad b'har abayit ve'echad b'chel. Nitzrach echad me'an halacha. Holech etzel beis din shebi'iro. Ein beit din shebi'iro. Holech le beit din ha-samuch le'iro. In shamu. Omar lehem im lav. Hu v'hamuf le'shebahen. Ba'in le beit din shebahar abayit. In shamu. Amru lehem. V'im lav. Hu v'hamuf le'shebahen. Ba'in le beit din shebechel. Right, so you had a system of appeals, but it wasn't really appeals. It was, did they know the answer or not? If they had heard, right? It's being conceived of in a way that it's just a question of tradition. Did we hear this halacha? Do we know what the halacha says about this or not? If they hadn't heard, they would go to the next court. If they hadn't heard, they would go to the next court. Second to last line. Nishala she'ela. So they would ask the question at the high court. Im shom'u, if they had heard, amru lahem, they would answer. Im lav, if they hadn't heard, omdin l'minyan, they would take a vote. Im ru mitamim, tim'u, if most people said it's impure, then it was rendered impure. Rabu mitaharin tiharu, if most said it was pure, then they said it's pure. Misham halacha rovachat b'Yisrael, that's how halacha spread out in Israel. Mishirabu Talmidei Shammai v'Hillel Shaloshim Kol Tzarkan, when the students of Hillel and Shammai proliferated, and who hadn't sufficiently apprenticed, Hirbu Machlokot b'Yisrael v'Na'asu Shtei Torot. The Torah became like two Torahs.
Almost seems like an editorial, not only a recounting.
That's certain.
How do you square this with the notion that you had one of the zugot was av beit din, the other one was the sagan,
mm-hmm.
and one said yes and one said no? It doesn't sound like...
Well, that was the only machloket.
That was the only
machloket that they had.
The nasi was a sagan? Yeah, the nasi and the av beit din.
Yeah, the nasi and the av beit din.
It wasn't... There were two separate institutions.
But they had different responsibilities.
Correct, but they had equal power, so to speak. One wasn't a sagan to the other.
One of these sources of the vice president.
It's kind of weird.
They actually had, one was more of a ceremonial, and the other one was more, like the biggest Talmud Chacham was the Av Beis Din, and a ceremonial, often hereditary title was the Nasi.
It's just kind of interesting. You're talking, we got Torah, whatever, 1200 BCE, worth all the times of the Malachim and everything. We don't, whatever the halacha, then what did people do? What was the Torah Sheval Peh? Okay, it was kept. Then finally gets to Anshei Knesset Gadol and everybody, and then the Sanhedrin, and now it was one for all that time, till about 300, so in theory 900 years. And all of a sudden, within 200 time period, it all becomes...
Right, so the Mishnah...
There was no focus before that. The whole business,
but it was resolved.
Ruth and Boaz. His brother held that he couldn't marry a Basma Boav, and he held that he could. It was a malchokas.
Okay. So,
like this one. We got
There are all kinds of... The Gemara takes stories that for much earlier on and reads machloket into them. Okay? It's clear from this source that at least Rabbi Yossi felt that there was no... that you may have had disagreements, but there was always a way to resolve disagreements.
Got it. So there might have been machloket before, but as long as you had the Sanhedrin, it was all...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So now...
You said Nasi. That's the Nasi that's
Like Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi.
Hanasi, who is the from the David usually now?
From the descendants of Hillel. Hillel is deemed the progenitor of the line of Nisiyim throughout the period of the Mishnah and, you know, on into the period of the Gemara.
They were political leaders, no?
They were also political leaders, yes.
But they were
They were recognized by Rome as being the patriarchs of the Jews. And yes, they were also They were also the heads of the Sanhedrin. What's that?
So they were heads of the Sanhedrin enough that they could argue with the Av Beis Din.
Well, enough that they could argue with the Av Beis Din. They weren't necessarily the greatest Talmud Chacham of their generations, right? But the fact that they had a certain pedigree meant that their positions were respected. For example, you have the story of Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yehoshua, where Rabbi Yehoshua was, you know, even at the end of the story, Rabbi Gamliel says to him, "You're my Rebbe because you know more than me and you teach me, but you're also my Talmud because you accept my decision." Right? That was the story about how Rabbi Gamliel forced Rabbi Yehoshua to show up on the day that Rabbi Yehoshua thought was Yom Kippur. Rabbi Yehoshua was the Av Beit Din. And they deposed Rabbi Gamliel for it, and the truth of the matter is, after the Churban Bayit, one of the primary powers, and we're going to see this later on into the time of the Gaonim, one of the major... How does a Beit Din exercise its power? When, you know, on one hand, you could have a legal pluralism where different groups within a single polity choose, right? They venue shop. They choose where they're going to see their cases. That might be a little bit anachronistic in this respect. When you talk about, you know, if the law of the land is Roman law, then what is the power of the Beit Din? What powers does the Beit Din have? So one of the primary powers, one of the key powers, is determining the calendar. If you control the calendar, then you control the entire routine of Jewish life. You're the one who's, you decide when the chagim are, you decide when to add an extra month and when not to add an extra month. You decide when Rosh Chodesh is, when Rosh Chodesh isn't. Right? At this point, they weren't doing capital punishment. 40 years before the destruction of Beit HaMikdash, they stopped doing capital punishment. So you could have, they could have been judging monetary cases between Jews, but when the law of the land is Rome, if people went to the Roman courts, then they went to the Roman courts. They could go to any, there were multiple adjudicators, there were multiple arbitrators. You had Christian holy men who were arbitrating cases in these times. So how do you demonstrate power? What does the Beit Din have real control over? One of the very few things that they really have control over is the calendar, right? And we'll see that throughout Jewish history, the calendar is very often, at least until the time of the Gaonim, the calendar is a site of real struggle. You have it with Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yehoshua. You have it between Bavel and Eretz Yisrael. You have it within Bavel. Okay.
You also have excommunication, no?
For that, you need... Right, but that's a local thing usually for a guy that didn't pay taxes. You're not determining anything for the whole Jewish community through excommunication. It's a local phenomenon. Okay. So what did the Zugot do? Right? They didn't argue with each other, apparently. We actually don't have that much on any of the individual Zugot. And the most that we have is on Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach. But let's say there's a Mishnah in Ediot. We'll go through some of these sources quickly. Top of the second page. A Braita in Shabbat. Yosi ben Yoezer, Ish Tzereda. Yosi ben Yochanan, Ish Yerushalayim. Gazru Tuma al Eretz Ahamim. Said that there's Tuma outside of Eretz Yisrael. Val Klei Zechuchit. And they decreed that Klei Zechuchit, that glass vessels can become impure. Shimon ben Shetach tikein ketuba l'isha. Shimon ben Shetach was mitakein that a woman gets a ketuba, right? And the li'isha is important there. A ketuba is entirely to the woman's benefit. Because our tuma al kli matchot, and he decreed that metal vessels can become impure. That is Do'oraita. He expanded the Do'oraita to the details I didn't look into.
Probably other metal vessels besides the six that are mentioned in the pasuk.
Could be also how tuma is conveyed and what conveys tuma to a metal vessel. Okay. So Tuma and Tara is something that we don't really, it's not really part of our lives today. It was very much a part of their lives then. And as imports and exports, as Judea becomes more integrated with the Greco-Roman world, there's a need to adapt. And these kelim, how do we deal with these kelim? So they made gezerot. Now gezerot is something we started talking about it a little bit before. We talked about the five levels of Torah Sheba'al Peh. So we talked about the first three are all considered Do'oraita. The last two are considered Dirabanan. And one of them is a Gezerah. Right? A Gezerah can be an independent Gezerah, or it can be an extension of an existing Isur. Okay, and we see both types in this Mishnah. Shimon ben Shetach was mitakein ketubah. Ketubah, there isn't really anything akin to a ketubah in the Torah. Right, you have a dowry, right, but that's something that's given at the beginning of a marriage. A ketubah is essentially a prenuptial agreement that makes it difficult for a man to divorce his wife. And that's the purpose of it. To make it difficult for men to divorce their wives. It details what a man would have to pay, or who he would have to support within the context of marriage, and if the marriage were to end in death or in divorce. And the other one, Tuma al Kli Batchot, is an extension or an expansion of existing Yisur. Rabbi Yossi ben Yoezer, right? The Mishnah in Ediot. Ediot is one of the most fascinating and unique Masechtas of Mishnah. What it is it's a series of Ediot, of testimonies. One rabbi says, one rabbi says, I saw that they did this, 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 and this in the Beit HaMikdash. So,
or this was a result of the story of Rabbi Yeshua.
Right.
They let everybody in.
The beginning of Ediot is that when they open the doors of the Beit Midrash in Yavne, and all kinds of people showed up, they brought different traditions, different testimonies from things that they had seen and things that they had heard. And that was what was recorded, and that was the day that Ediot was written. The other day that Ediot was written, and we're going to get to this also, because it's also a very important day, is right after the Bar Kokhba rebellion. The rabbis were decimated. The rabbinic leadership was mostly killed. There were only a few left. And the Romans had taken away any semi-autonomy that the Jews had. It was at that point, according to Masechet Ediot, that they said, anybody that has any edut should come. Right. And that day also, it was almost like a second Yavne, that day also was a day, and this is around the year This is around the year 140. Okay, so the first one is around the year 80 or 90, and then the second one is around the year 140. But we digress. So he said, he was made in three things. Al-Ayl Kamtza D'chun. That the Ayl Kamtza, a certain type of locust, is pure. It's kosher. Al-Mashka Beit Mitzbechaya. About the liquid, the fluid in the slaughterhouse of the Beit HaMikdash, the Inun Dachyan, that they are pure. Udiyakrav Bimita, and that one who touches a dead body, Mista'av, is impure. Vikarule Yose Sharia. They called him Yosi the Makil. Yosi the Permitter, not Pearl Mutter, Permitter. Okay.
Unusual Mishnah has so much Aramaic in it.
Oh, excellent point. That's what I was about to bring up. Why would this Mishnah be in Aramaic?
Well, because if it's just if somebody came in, you know, more of the folk, so to speak, that would be the language they speak.
This was probably 140. This is probably later when Hebrew was...
This is much earlier. This is Yossi ben Yoezer. He's one of the Zugot. He's the first generation of Zugot. Wow. This is around the time of the... This is around the time of the Maccabees.
Right.
Okay? So, that was the language. If you look in Pirkei Avot, the traditions that are ascribed to Hillel himself... Mm-hmm. Now, Hillel might not be the best example, because Hillel himself was born in Bavel... They're all in Aramaic. Al da'atfuch yatfuch. Right. And... Lufun tsaro agro. There are a few others, early traditions, that are from that are in Aramaic. Now, once the Mishnah got underway, they were specifically trying to do it in Hebrew. They wanted to do it in Hebrew. It's not... It's kind of counterintuitive that it would be in Hebrew. Hebrew is not a spoken, was not a spoken language. In the New Testament, Jesus speaks
Aramaic.
Mm-hmm. Right? Eli, Eli, lama shavaktani. Which is the Aramaic translation of lama azavtani. Right? Lishvok is to give up, to abandon. And we say it in Kol Nidre, Shivikin.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, Lama Shavaktani, why did you cast me away? This is the lingua franca. This is what the Jews, this is what everybody in the eastern, in the western part of the Persian Empire spoke, and later, it's what the Jews continued to speak until, you know, well, probably until the Arab era. When they started speaking Arabic. So, the Mishnayot that are in Hebrew, which is most Mishnayot, those are the ones that you can see that this is already part of a literary project. This is part of something that we want it to be memorizable. We want it to be, we want to facilitate mnemonics. The earlier traditions, if they're going to be recorded, if they're going to be transmitted how they were said, then it's going to be transmitted in Aramaic.
So how did Hebrew get reintroduced?
I can venture an answer, but the real answer is I don't know. I don't know why they went back to Hebrew specifically. I think, what I and this is, again, speculation, but... I think that they were trying to create something which would have been seen as a restatement of the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
Or a... But they didn't want it to be in the spoken language. They wanted to. They wanted it to be in the language of the Torah because they wanted it to be...
Maybe because they wanted to require Masorah to go with it, that you couldn't just read it and translate it. You needed somebody to teach it.
Well, it wasn't written down either. The Mishnah was not written down.
No.
Not until much, much later.
So all halachas come of a comma. It's
still right. It's formulated in a way that facilitates memory. Right? They were memorized. And I think they wanted it, again, like I said, there are Greek-speaking Jews, there are Aramaic-speaking Jews. There was this awareness that Jews are being dispersed, that Jews are being scattered. The thinking is, let's do this in Hebrew when we transmit it, so that Hebrew will always be the Jewish language, even if Aramaic stops being the Jewish language. The Torah will always be in Hebrew. And even though I mentioned Philo before, it's not clear whether or not Philo read Hebrew. He was familiar with the Torah in Greek. And here also, if you ask your average
Greek
Christian today, what language is the Bible in? They'll tell you, yeah, the Bible's in whatever language I read. Right? The idea that that something translated is something less than the original is not a foregone conclusion. Right? Chazal were sensitive to this, but others weren't. Right? Martin Luther, he translates it into German. But one of the key tenets of his Reformation is sola scriptura, right? We return to scripture. We read scripture alone. We don't let other people tell me how to interpret it. I interpret it on my own. But for most people that he's talking to, for most of his audience, they're not returning to the scripture. They're returning to a translation of the scripture. So the idea that And it didn't occur to them. It didn't dawn on the average reader that this is something that is not the original. What do you mean? You know, when people say, it's like, it says straight out in the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill. Like, well, that's not what it says. It says lo tirtzach. And how do you translate that? Don't kill, don't murder. There's differences, but it doesn't say don't kill.
So you brought this Mishnah just to show us that it was in Aramaic, or was there another?
And also, this is one of the few attestations. This is one of the few things that we have from Yossi ben Yoezer. Okay, another person by the name, and this is in Breishit Rabbah source, the Breishit Rabbah source, Yakum Ish Tzrorot. Yakum was Alkemas. He was a Kohen Gadol just before the time of the Maccabees, of the Chashmonaim, and he had bought it. He was a nephew of Yossi ben Yoezer, Ish Tzreda, Avarochev Susa, Bishabta. He would ride his horse on Shabbat. Azal Kome Sharita Dimitztavla, Amarle, Chame Susi de Erkevi Mare, Chame Susach de Erkevi Mare. Look at my horse, look at your horse, meaning I've got power, you've got nothing. And so they have this whole back and forth that Yossi ben Yoezer gave Musar to his nephew. His nephew essentially committed suicide. Nechnasno abavar ke'eras shal achna. Yossi ben Yoezer's words entered his nephew's ears like the venom of a snake. And then he went and he performed all four of the mitot bezdin on himself. Skila Srefa Harag Bechenek, and it describes exactly how he did that. And in the end, he went to Gan Eden. Now this Yakum, he's mentioned in other sources. He's mentioned by Josephus, and he's mentioned in Sefer HaChashmonaim as Alkemas, right, as being one of the Kohanim Gedolim who purchased the office. So here you have, amongst the first, you usually do not have a you can date Yossi ben Yoezer based on this, right? That if Alkemas, who's a generation or two before the Chashmonaim, or right before the Chashmonaim, a little bit later than that.
Chashmonaim
are about 160. So this is 170, 180 before the Common Era. So now we can put a date on Yossi ben Yoezer, and we can put a date on his death. Now, here's another story where the dating doesn't work so well.
How do you put a date on his death?
because he's dying in this one. This is a Gemara that you might not have in your Gemaras at home. Tanu Rabbanan, la'olam tehed smol dochev yamin mekarevet. You should always push away with your left, but bring close to the with your right hand. Not like Elisha ben Avuya, who pushed away Gehazi, and not like Rabbi Yehoshua ben Paracha, shedachafo lehanotzri b'shtei yadav.
That's not Elisha ben Avuya, that's Elisha ben Avuya.
I'm sorry, I meant, right, Elisha Hanavi. Sorry. Not like Yehoshua ben Parachia, who pushed away his student, Jesus, with two hands. What was the story? Kid to have a kakutal Yanai Malka l'Rabbanan. King Yanai killed all the rabbis. King Yanai was one of the Chashmonai kings. He killed all the rabbis. One of them he spared because it was his brother-in-law. That was Shimon ben Shetach. And a bunch of others, like Yehoshua ben Parachia, fled. So Shimon ben Shetach atminu achte. Shimon ben Shetach was hidden by his sister, who was the queen, Shlom Tzion. Yehoshua ben Parachia azal arak l'Alexandria shel Mitzrayim. Yehoshua ben Parachia fled to Alexandria. Ki hava shalma, when there was peace. And there's a double entendre there because the name of the queen was Shalom Tzion or Shaloma. Shalach Leila Shimon ben Shetach sent for Yehoshua ben Parachia, says, I'm calling you from Yerushalayim, Ira Kodesh, to Alexandria. We need you back. Fine. Ki'ata, when he was coming back, ikla lahahu ushpiza, they were at an inn, kum kamayhu biyakra shafir avdila yik. He saw that they gave him great honor. One of his students, Amarle Echad mi Talmidav, one of his students, right, and we saw before, this is talking about Jesus. He said, Rebbe, my teacher, Eineha Trutot, the eyes of the innkeeper's wife are narrow, right? He's like, don't say it's so nice, it's not so great. Amarle Russia, you're Russia, Bekachata Osek, this is what you're up to? Avik arba mea shufore, took out 400 shofarot, bishamte, and he put him in chirim. Kol yoma ata lekame velo kible. Every day he came back, and he wouldn't be makabel him. Yomachad havikari kriyat shema. One day Rabbi Yehoshua ben Parachia was reading kriyat shema, ata lekame, and he came before him. Havibidate lekabule. Yehoshua ben Parachia, he had in mind that he was going to take him back that day. Achvile biyade, but he gestured with his hand, like 1 second, or something like that. He just gestured with his hand, Savar Midcha Dachile. And Jesus, the student, thought, oh, he's pushing me away again. Azal Zakaf Levinta Palcha. He went and he set up a he set up some sort of Avodah Zara. Some sort of monolith. Amar Le Chazorbach. He said, Du tshuva, Amar Le Kach Mekublanim Imcha. I understood from you. Kol achote u'machtias arabim in maspikim liyado la'asos tshuva. If you're already a machtias arabim, you can't. There's no way to do tshuva. The amar mar kishay v'hizis v'idich v'hechtias Yisrael. He caused the Jewish people to sin. Okay, we'll pick it up again, but here the timing is off. Shimon ben Shetach is at the time of Yanai Malka. It's 100 years before the Jesus of the New Testament lived. So we'll have to figure that out.